Hello, and welcome to Expected Value, the podcast that goes inside the sports analytics world. I'm Paul Carr from True Media. This is episode 73 of the show on the NFL front. 73 could be represented by Hall of Fame offensive lineman John Hanna, Ron Yeary, among others. The year 1973 also marked the first time that the swimming world championships were held. This was the year after Mark Spitz won a record 7 gold medals at the Munich Olympics. Spitz retired before Worlds the next year, but the U.S. did still win the most medals at the first World Championships, 2 more than East Germany. I bring all that up because our guest today is from the swimming world. 2024 is an Olympic year. We're about a month from the U.S. Olympic trials in Indianapolis, 2 months from the Olympic Games themselves in Paris. Swimming is one of the biggest sports from an American point of view at the Olympics. So before everything got too crazy for him, we wanted to talk with Dr. Curtis Goss of USA Swimming. Curtis is a performance support specialist for the U.S. national team, which will again be one of the swimming favorites along with Australia in Paris. This is a bit of a personal deep dive as well. My dad swam in college. I grew up swimming competitively, first in summer league and then on a year-round club team in my high school years. Still swim recreationally, so it's long been an important part of my life. But we're not here to talk about that. In this conversation, Curtis will talk about what USA Swimming does, particularly in relation to the Olympics, what his role is as a performance support specialist, what data is available in the competitive swimming world, what kinds of tools are used to track swimming data, the challenges and limitations of swimming data tracking, communicating that data to swimmers and coaches, different strategies that can be affected by data collection. We'll also get into his academic background and path to USA Swimming, where other Olympic sports are data-wise, and the top storylines that he is looking forward to at the Olympic trials. Then our new producer, Brian Duffley, will join me to react and wrap things up. Without further ado, here's the Expected Value conversation with USA Swimming's Curtis Goss. We're joined now on Expected Value by Curtis Goss of USA Swimming, where he's a performance support specialist for the U.S. national team. Curtis, welcome to the show. Let's start at a very high level for people who aren't familiar with the structure of swimming in the United States. What is USA Swimming as an organization?
Yeah, so USA Swimming is what's called the National Governing Body for Swimming, or NGB. And so basically what we do is exactly what it sounds like. We're the government organization for competitive swimming in the country. We're essentially ordained by the U.S. Olympic Paralympic Committee, or USOPC, to develop the Olympic team. And so that happens on a lot of levels. It's not just my level, where I work with the national team, which is just the best 6 people in each event each year, but it's also the developmental level. So we've got Learn to Swim, we've got 10 and unders, 14 and unders, and so on and so forth. And we handle pretty much every stage of the development of our nation's swimmers.
So we're recording this a few weeks before Olympic trials. And trials in the Olympics are obviously where USA Swimming is the most visible to the casual sports fan, casual eye in the U.S. So what is the org doing on the whole? We'll get into your role specifically, but on the whole, what are you doing in the next couple months to prep and execute during the Olympics?
Well, it's really exciting. We actually just had an all-staff meeting this morning about how Olympic trials is going to work, because Olympic trials is kind of its own beast, just in the sense of the swimming itself is... In the swimming world, you might hear that the U.S. Olympic swimming trials is a more competitive meet than the actual Olympics are. And that's certainly true for several events, like the women's 200 IM. If we've got 5 women that easily could be in the top 8 at the Olympics if all 5 could swim.
So
it is an extremely competitive meet that's happening. And it's happening for the first time in a football stadium. So we actually... I think might have the most people that ever attend a swim meet, I think is the set goal for this meet. And so we're essentially taking up running goal or sideline to sideline at Lucas Oil Stadium for about half the stadium. So it's going to be the biggest venue that we've ever held Olympic trials in. And there's so much going on in the event surrounding the event. So it's almost like going to be an all-star game sort of atmosphere that we have going for this. And there's all sorts of everything that you can imagine. There's musical events going on, all sorts of other swimming adjacent events. I think even like the athlete lounge is going to have like therapy dogs and things like this. So it's a whole event that we have going. On my end, we're going to get to use RoboCams for the first time to do our race analysis. So we're really excited about that process. And another portion is the athlete seating is going to be right on the side of the pool, and their athletes and coaches are going to have a really, really good view of the event. And it's just going to be a big, big place to hold a swim meet. We're usually used to much smaller venues, and in Indianapolis. So, as an Indiana University grad, it's exciting to even though it's not my home state, it's excited to get back to the state of Indiana and see some fast swimming.
Very cool. I'm excited for that. Let's talk about your role specifically. What does a performance support specialist in general do for the national team?
A lot of different things. Mostly we focus on three buckets. So the first one is what I was just talking about, the video component. So we take video of each person's race on the national team at meets that we go to. But for Olympic trials, we are going to video everything because it's kind of the Wild West. We have no idea who's going to be making semifinals and finals. And so our job is to essentially be there with video if they want to review their race and get any little technical tidbits in when they advance from prelims to semis and semis to finals. So the video piece, and then with the video and sometimes live, we do simple race analysis. So if you've ever watched swimming, obviously there's doing several lengths of the pool. So we get the split times for those. And we take their stroke tempo and count their strokes and send that to them in just a generalized report with if they have other races in our database. It'll have comparison to past races and things like that, comparison to the world American record. And so we do that. And then really the other, I would say probably 70% of my job is just the classic other duties as assigned. Really that's a lot of different buckets is, okay, how do we improve our process on the race analysis side and the video side and become more efficient or get data to more people, or more granular data to more people. But also it's as simple as like, we need somebody to, we're loading a bus to Singapore and we need somebody to move bags. And that's what you're going to do is even like last night, there's, a group of swimmers at the training center here. And somebody needed an exam proctored to finish their sophomore year of college. So I was here 8 to 10 p.m. last night proctoring an exam and reprising my role from graduate school to do that for her. And so there's lots of different things that we just kind of, whatever is going to make the lives of our athletes easier and make sure that all they have to do when they show up to the pool is just focus on going from one side of the pool to the other. And that's all that they should need to have to do.
What kind of data is out there? What are you using? Obviously there's times, but including whether it's breaking down that or beyond that, what's out there for you?
Primarily times. You can get more granular with like split times and things like that. But really we're kind of in our infancy in terms of race metrics and what we're actually looking at from a data perspective, just because it's really difficult to get swimming data. Mm-hmm. Just because whereas you can do pose estimation and all sorts of things on the ground, it's really hard to do that with the variable of water. Is pretty much as soon as you lose somebody's head from them splashing around, it becomes really hard to track people. So really most of our process right now is manual. It's me, several other people using a manual program to track tempo and track strokes. And really what we're looking for there is not necessarily trying to bin people into this is a good tempo, this is a bad tempo, because like we've got, I guess you'd call it maybe like a democracy of bodies in the sport, right? It's like we've got to be helping people that are 6'9", we've got to be helping people that are 5'7", go through their races. And so we can't just try to fit everybody into one box. And if I said, well, here's, you know, Michael Phelps's statistics and everybody should swim like Michael, it's like, well, easier said than done. Good luck doing that. And so just trying to build people's stories with the tempo, and it's in playing that game with them of, well, what did you think you were doing? What was the plan? Well, here's what you actually did, and here's where you started to slow down. We could get even more granular and say, this is the time it took to get to different segments in the pool and things like that, and say, okay, well, you sped up your tempo in the second part of this length, when really you should have kind of held on and maybe established something early, and kind of play that game with them and see where they're at. But really it's we're at the point, and I don't think we'll ever get away with from this, and I don't think we ever should, is that it takes a lot of communication with the athlete, with the coach, because so much of it is paired to what was the intention. And then we've got the data that says, okay, what was the actual outcome? And because really tempo, I was going to say tempo and stroke count really don't tell the entire story. And so really you have to piece things together with their history, with what the intention was, with what they've been doing in training to kind of bring that to life for the swimmer.
Things like, whether it's as simple as a watch or something in a cap or things like that. How much are these things used? Have you experimented with them? And where are things like that, the gadget world, I guess I would just say, from especially at the high levels of swimming, where's that?
Yeah, so as of January 1st, 2023, the international governing body for swimming called World Aquatics legalized wearable technology in swimming and did it kind of in such a way that you really can't, they outlawed feedback devices. So pretty much anything wrist worn is going to be out of the picture.
This is during races, I presume.
This is during racing scenarios. Yes. Yeah. And so there are some head worn sensors. And we've had discussions about utilizing those. I think with the head worn sensors, a lot of athletes are kind of averse to having something on their head, even if it's not really inhibiting them. So really finding different places on the body or making the devices smaller is always going to be the kind of pressure on these devices. So we aren't using any devices just yet. We're still kind of looking into that and seeing where we want to go. But it's really exciting in the sense of there's a great researcher, his name's Dr. Ken Ono, who's working at the University of Virginia, who's worked with a lot of different swimmers in our country. And what they do is use just a basic accelerometer, but they mount it actually on the swimmer's hip. So they have to wear this kind of like clunky belt. So it would never really work in a racing scenario as is. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is, well, essentially swimming is just an acceleration contest, right? If you have the highest net acceleration or highest net velocity in the race, you win the race. And it's really that simple. And so we can get a little bit more granular with developing graphical profiles on people and overlaying and saying, okay, well, this person with really good, you know, underwater dolphin kicks gets this much more acceleration, or they have this pattern on their stroke, or you're losing acceleration here. That's where we can start to get a little bit more granular, but we're not quite there in a racing scenario. This is a setup that takes a lot of time. It takes a whole calibration process of the athlete like standing still for 10 seconds. We additionally have the belt. And then we also have it really is like a lot of processing time and a lot of manual processing time to complete this.
So none of this tech, or as you tell me, how is this tech being used at all in practice at all? Like, do you use any of this wearables there? And I'm curious, how does it translate to meets? Because obviously it meets your whatever, you're sprinting harder. It's a different kind of scenario. Your purposes are different in a set during practice versus a meet. How do you use it all during a practice, and how does that translate to a different competitive environment?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll start by saying we don't really do too much of practice data right now, we being USA Swimming.
Yeah.
Just because of the nature of our program is it's almost like our always season is the off season for most professional sports, right? Is like in professional sports, like baseball is like people are off working with their personal trainers, their hitting coaches, their own sort of like personal entourage of folks. And that's what we are operating on all of the time, is most of our swimmers, or I should say none of our swimmers really are training at the training center full time in Colorado Springs. And so we're spread out all across the US. And so it's one of those challenges that this is, especially on the data side, that we're looking to solve, just to have extra touch points in how we interact. Cause it's like, I cannot possibly visit. I think we visited 75% of national team athletes in the past year. Mm-hmm. But that's really 1 to 2 touch points that we get with them outside of meets.
Gotcha.
And so wearables are going to be really important, and anything technological, whether that's like a computer vision, some tracking that somebody can set up to look at their practices, that's going to be super important as we go forward if we try to bring people in, even though we're decentralized. Gotcha. So that's one component. But yeah, a lot of people are using wearable technology in practices. And this is a really, really good use case, especially because a lot of times coaches are not coaching a very small group of people. Mm-hmm. They're responsible for pretty large groups of people. A lot of the best swimmers in our country are coached by college coaches. So they've got not only the responsibility of maybe a small group of pro swimmers, but they've also got 50, 60, sometimes 70 college swimmers that they're also responsible for at the same time. And to be able to critically look at everybody's practices just with your own eyes is going to be next to impossible. And so this is one place that people have been really successful with wearables, is to kind of like, okay, you've got that on, and now I've got the story of your practice that I can look at whenever I want. I've got the story of your practice week over time, and we can start to track a lot of these things. So that's one component. And then the other component is a lot of people focused on heart rate as a measurable variable for swimming. And so that's one great thing about the head-worn, devices, is that they can sit right on your goggle strap, which sits right in your temple. And so a lot of them can pick up heart rate pretty well from your temple.
Okay.
And so a lot of coaches are using that with either a TV right by the deck that has everybody's heart rate laid out. Because then you sort of get away from a couple different problems. One is I love the idea of, right, as we have now have this objective arbiter of what is going on. And it's a good touch point for a conversation, because now it's not coach's word against the athletes, athletes' word against the coaches, right? It's like when I was swimming, I took my heart rate with my two fingers on my neck.
Right.
And I told the coach the number that he wanted to hear at the time. Right. And it was right. And you can sort of lie and play that game. And then, you know, so you figure out the right answer very quickly. So what this has done is kind of reveal a whole new world to the coaches of, okay, now I've got this, wow, people are swimming the same speed with different heart rates, and everybody can kind of have their own heart rate profile that you can look at over time.
Nice.
Because if I'm an athlete and I come into practice and I'm doing a similar set to what I did 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and I'm swimming faster and my heart rate's the same, okay, that's a good sign. That's an improvement. If my heart rate's higher and I'm not swimming any faster, okay, maybe there's something going on here that I need to address. And so it's a really, really good objective arbiter of what's going on and an objective touch point, so that the athlete and the coach can kind of look at that, get on the same page together, and kind of take the sort of blame or anything like that. Not that that happens a lot, but I was just one of those, you know, one of those swimmers where you figure out the right answer pretty quickly and you're like, yeah, that's my heart rate, coach. Okay. Yep. And then you move on.
What other, physiologically, what other data is out there generally tracked? Heart rate, I don't know if it's lung capacity, something. What else are people generally using in the swimming world?
Heart rate is going to be the main one, just because that's what a lot of training paradigms are kind of based off of, is heart rate zones. They can be a little bit tricky because it's one of those measures that there's the average heart rates, but nobody is ever going to be average. They're all on a range. And if you average your group, it will be the average heart rate response, right, but really nobody ever hits the average heart rate response. So that's one big thing that's happening in physiology. The other one is sort of using qualitative information to get at physiological information. Mm-hmm. Is there really aren't too many I haven't seen a wearable necessarily that is outperforming just a simple check-in questionnaire, right? Is in physiology, the criterion measure for any sort of like overtraining or overreaching measure is a mood state questionnaire. And so you can actually, if you do like a research mood state questionnaire, it's like 50 questions and you have to define all the words and it's kind of cumbersome. A lot of researchers or practitioners, I should say, in sports science have had success with even just nailing that down to a set of 5 questions is something that we've tried to do, is just say, okay, how did you sleep last night? Are you fatigued? Like, how do you feel fatigue wise today? How do you feel soreness wise today? What is your mood? And then you have, again, a jumping off point of like, okay, now I've got the athlete saying that, rather than me having to You know, if I'm a coach, I don't want to see my athletes' Saturday night sleep data. I don't. And so it gives them just kind of their own space to advocate for themselves or not. Right. And that can be a touch point as well of just, okay, I've got this sheet of now it can facilitate a human conversation with my athlete. So I don't need to necessarily try to do any body language reading or anything like that. Is I can just get right to the point and figure out what's going on and what they need. So that's been a big one too, is people have had a lot of success with just very, very simple questionnaires each day. And you can track these things pretty sensitively over time. And if somebody says like stress is another one, it's like, I've had some good conversations come from people saying, I'm stressed. It's like, well, why are you stressed? There could be, you know, job obligations going on, school obligations. Sometimes people come to, when they are training at the training center, people can get a little bit stir crazy, just because it's so concentrated of an environment and things like that. But it's just an awesome touch point to get at what is physiologically happening, but I don't need to take any blood, any biomarkers, deal with any health information, anything like that. Just really simple check-ins to facilitate human conversations.
So you've mentioned stroke tempo, stroke efficiency type of thing. It's an example, yep, kind of a start to finish example of how that is, like how you track it, what you do with it, what a swimmer may or may not want to adjust, or a coach when you hear that data.
Absolutely. So we have a program that was built in, I believe it was 2009, where essentially your arrow keys on your keyboard turn into sort of like an interactive pad. Okay. So when you watch the Olympics, is I'm going to be up in the stands pressing my left arrow key every time somebody takes a stroke. Okay. That's how it goes. And it's a pretty nifty program. Is then you hit the right arrow key to go to the next length. And up arrow keys, if people finish, like if they started on their left arm on freestyle and they finish on their right. And so all of that gets sort of automatically put together for us in a report. I hand enter the split times. Right. And then the one new thing, if you could call it that we've been doing is just, I joke that I know enough coding to get me in trouble with R just from my academic background. Yep. And so I built a little thing in R that ingests that data and puts it into, because right now the data are stored in XML files. Each meet is an XML file.
Yeah.
And just really clunky data to work with. And so it puts it into an actual data frame and then uses R Markdown to generate a report. And then I was excited to collaborate with our IT department, I've also got an email list. So it just generates a report that has the person's best races, if we have those in our system, similar races. So that's races basically in the same month, because our calendar year is pretty much the same year over year. Mm-hmm. And then indexes them to the world and American record just for their posterity. And that gets sent off to them and their coach. And then from there, it's really just conversations through the video and trying to diagnose whatever we can at different points of the season. So we might be a little bit more adventurous with advice and things like that early in the season. So like November to January, to try to get feedback and see if they can incorporate that into their training. Right now, it's sort of like thumbs up, things look great. If there's something simple that we're going to tweak, we can maybe do that, but really right now it's sort of your mechanics are your mechanics and how you swim is how you swim. If it's not absolutely egregious, we're not going to touch it, because this is so locked in. Most of them have been doing this since they were, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old. And this is so ingrained.
Is there, so in say the NBA, we've seen the game change over the past decade-ish. To layups and threes, more or less. NFL, the passing game has changed more. And a lot of this is data-driven. Is there anything in swimming that data or information in general has changed over the last, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years, anything like that?
Definitely. Two main things that come to mind is, one is training paradigms, is that people are doing a lot less than they used to. And it's just kind of a matter of, I think people are, obligations are exploding. You only have so much time to swim. only have so much time to train. And so how do I, as the coach, reduce the load of all of the extra stuff? How do I eliminate the fluff out of my program to get to the essentials so that when I'm occupying somebody's time, I know it's going to be high impact? So that's been a big one that's kind of reshaped training. And I guess data and analysis wise, I would say the Australians have been amazing at getting their data going, just in the sense that they've got a partnership with AWS that they're working through, and they've got really good collaborations through like Australian Institute of Sport and several other universities in Australia. So one thing that they've been coming out with tons of literature. One thing that we've noticed that they were doing at international meets was, and it's the same sort of thing with the Brits, is they're kind of, I'll call it like skating through the first half to three quarters of their races and playing the game of, because right, we're a time-based sport. And at some point, you know, you have to go a certain time in the first half if you want to go a certain time in the second half. You're limited as the race goes on. And so it's like, okay, well, if I want to go like 47 in the 100 freestyle as a man, well, I have to be out under 23. Okay. So how do I go a time under 23 in the easiest possible way so that I'm building into that wall and I can come off that wall? And now all the problem is me getting through the second half of my race. I think a lot of times, especially with, I think this is tough with short course, right? Is short course swimming. So for those that aren't familiar, in the US, we swim short course yards for high school and college meets. So that would be 25 yard pools. Olympic competitions, international competitions are 50 meters. So a very different scale of problem. And it's I say this as somebody that as a shorter guy than most of my competitors. So I survived on the walls. The short course was my game. Kicking underwater was my game. And so I had a hard time with the long course because I didn't have the wall to save me. And so I think we're sort of getting into, okay, how do we adapt ourselves to solve that problem of, okay, I need to go this time in the first half. How do I do that in the easiest possible way so that I can really put the pedal down in the second half? And the Australians have done a really good job of that. And they swim consistently across the board. They've published this research. It's like 3 or 4 year old research. So they're doing a really good job of collecting information at a really high level, communicating that information to the athletes. They've got a great structure for their kind of local local state swimming operations. And so they've done a really good job of using data to make decisions and try to find, okay, what is the easiest possible way for us to kind of do this so that when somebody does put the pedal down, it really jumps them to that next level in whatever portion of their race that it is.
All right. So I have a few questions that may or they may be silly. I don't know. But as someone who grew up like age group swimming, some of this is from things, you know, I think about when I'm still swimming for whatever, because I can't turn off my analyst brain. I'll start with the short course, long course thing. Is there anything different kind of from your performance perspective that you're doing when either analyzing or strategizing about short course versus long course races?
A little bit. We really don't deal too much in short course, except we have, so this is, I guess, the third course setup is short course meters. So instead of 25 yards, 25 meters, we do have a short course meters meet that we attend. There's a world championships. I think it's like every other December that we're going to be going to. It's in Budapest this year. And so really, we're just trying to make sure that people are sort of like keeping, we'll call it like keeping long course in the back of their mind while they're swimming short course and competing collegiately and trying to make sure that they don't solve long course problems. Sort of what I was talking about, solving long course problems with short course solutions.
Right.
We don't want that because it's very different when you're talking about somebody might take 3 stroke cycles or 6 like freestyle strokes in a short course yards pool and be at the other end. Whereas it takes 19, 20 cycles to do that in long course. It's a completely different game. So yes, making sure that people have distinct strategies and if needed, distinct biomechanics. This is another thing about swimming is that like when you think about biking, right, there's only so many degrees of freedom in terms of your ability to put pressure on pedals and turn a crank.
Right.
Is most people most people's mechanics, if the bike seat is set at the right height, if everything is working properly, is the efficiency differences between people really aren't that different. Running, it increases a little bit because there's more degrees of freedom interacting with the ground. Swimming, that just explodes because the water is just so unforgiving. Mm-hmm. And it resists you. You get to the exponential portion of the curve very, very quickly in terms of how the water is resisting you. And so if you want to go faster, it is an exponentially more difficult problem to do that anytime you want to go faster. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that we're working on solving, going from short course to long course, just making sure that you're managing your energy and kind of respecting the length of the pool.
Is there, what if any data is there to suggest optimal breathing patterns? I mean, obviously we're mostly talking freestyle here. Is there anything out there, whether it's a study, whether it's coaching methods, to suggest this is kind of what it should look like for a certain race?
Ask N swim coaches and you're going to get N plus one different opinions on this topic. So there's really not a set, kind of set optimum for anybody. A lot of people do. And that's the cool thing about our sport is that there's a lot of different people doing a lot of different things that go very similar times and they find it in very different ways. It makes my job harder because again, it's like, I'd love to just be like, okay, just be Michael Phelps. Easy enough. Right. Yeah. But that's not possible for a lot of bodies.
Yeah.
Right. And so you're trying to find the solution that's right for the person, right for the body, right for their attitude and things like that. But swimming breathing is really fascinating, mm-hmm. Just in the sense of when we talk about, as an exercise physiologist, is I've run a ton of biking, a ton of running VO2 max tests and have had the opportunity to run swimming VO2 max tests. And for those that aren't familiar with VO2 max or VO2 max tests, VO2 refers to the V is volume, O2 oxygen. So VO2 max refers to how much oxygen you can use in a minute. So essentially corresponds to aerobic capacity is basically what that is. And so you can do this in a pool. We do it in an endless pool. So it's essentially like a swimming treadmill, just spits water out the front and the swimmer swims against it. And so you can put the same swimmer on a bike and in the pool, and they'll achieve the same VO2 max. So they'll use the same amount of oxygen, so have the same aerobic capacity, but they will achieve that number in two completely different ways, on the bike versus during the swim. So they breathe about half, or I shouldn't say half as much. They breathe almost half as frequently, but they breathe about 20% less oxygen while they're swimming versus while they're biking. And there's a lot of different physiological advantages. It's called the diving reflex. As soon as your face goes into water, your heart rate slows down, your breathing rate decreases. It completely changes your physiology just by putting your face in water. And so it's a very different problem solving that for unlimited breathing scenarios, like running, like biking, because theoretically, well, you just breathe as much as you can and you've solved the problem. But with swimming, you have biomechanics that are introduced in there. So the biomechanical problem is you actually breathe in swimming with about an extra liter of air in your lungs, depending on how big your lungs are, because that helps with buoyancy. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier to swim on top of the water. You cut through water much more easily. And so people swim with a higher lung volume. So they're breathing basically 2 liters of air, but with 1 liter of air already more in their lungs. And so that's one component. The other component is it is disruptive to move your head to breathe. And so you have to be very selective about it. And so a lot of people will have kind of the strategy of breathe more early, breathe less late, in the sense of, well, the time course of oxygen getting from my mouth to my muscles is going to be longer than 10 seconds. And so theoretically for the last 10 seconds of my race, you see Caleb Dressel do this, is that he's very famous for not breathing on the last 25 yards of his 100 butterfly when he set the NCAA record. And he's figured out a way to, again, easier said than done, is because your body's producing all of the CO2 and telling you to breathe, 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 breathe. But managing that problem becomes very, very difficult. So a lot of people breathe early and then sort of put their head down late to kind of preserve their biomechanics as they're finishing the race. So you'll see that a lot.
Kind of related, and this is something that you probably heard growing up swimming, and I heard a lot, like, the time it was, you need to alternate sides you can breathe on, have the ability to do both. I feel like subjectively watching swimming now, there's much less of that at the highest level. Is that intentional? Is that just kind of the way it goes? Is there science or data behind that? What's the deal with breathing on the same side versus alternate side?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it's kind of two buckets. Is why people breathe on the same side during the race for the most part is just because it's a lot easier to get into a rhythm. And if you're, so it's like, I know that I had a good side and a bad side for just, I don't know what it was, but just how I could contort my body breathing to my right side versus breathing to my left side just allowed me to go faster and move things a lot better, sit higher in the water. And so you just sort of self-select that way. And so just a lot easier to kind of skate into that they call it a galloping stroke on freestyle. So it's a lot easier to skate into that. But what you'll see a lot is people in training incorporating breathing to both sides to kind of balance that out, because it if you aren't just at, and most people are not absolutely perfect with their mechanics, just breathing to one side, it really does grind into your shoulders in some ways. So a lot of people are using both sides breathing to kind of cultivate the body awareness and kind of cultivate that balance that then you can bring into your single sided breathing galloping stroke. So you'll see that a lot in training.
Yeah, that makes sense. You mentioned the galloping stroke. You see someone like Katie Ledecky doing that. Is that an intentional thing? Is there an efficiency to it? What's the thought process behind coaching or analyzing that or not out of somebody?
I don't think there's any like hard data that says exactly what's going on. What Katie does really, really well is you'll see when she does breathe, when she brings her arm back over, she kind of uses the momentum of that arm to launch past her pulling arm that's under her. And so she uses that phase of the stroke really, really well. And so it kind of balances a lot of different things of, okay, now I can have like a pretty good breathing rhythm, right? Is you're getting extra breaths if you're breathing to one side versus both. But also it kind of gives you that like kind of skate out on one side and you can really, really open up. And so you'll see her like drive that arm over the top and kind of launch into that X stroke. And she is like, she's the absolute best in the world at doing that. And you'll see the same thing with all of the sprint freestyle males, distance, like Bobby Fink does the same thing, is he really skates out on one side, and kind of uses that recovery to just drive into that next stroke. And it's just an amazing coordination of kind of just wrapping that arm. Cause it's really simple, right? Is if you want to go forward in the pool, your palm has to be facing the opposite direction. And so what these swimmers are really, really good at is getting their fingertips down, getting their palm back, and then the water is basically just a flat surface that they're pulling themselves past by doing that.
Nice. Now I have a lot to watch once we get to the trials and the Olympics. Let me ask you a few questions about your background, your path to where you are. You mentioned swam at Indiana and then got your, but so on the academic side, what was your major, what your post-grad work to kind of get to where you are today?
So I, from when I was, I think like 11 years old, is I wanted to be a dentist. That was the dream. I say unfortunately, but I shattered a dentist when I was an undergrad, and she was an amazing professional, thorough at her job, was so welcoming, extremely healthy workplace. It made me realize I did not want to go to dental school. And I felt awful telling her that, shadowing. And so what I did to kind of accommodate that path was, by chance, I was turned on to the human biology major as an undergrad, at Indiana, just because that incorporated anatomy and physiology. which were prereqs for dental school at that time, but not for medical school. So a lot of people that were doing like PT and dental school ended up being human biology majors. And so what I loved about human biology was how we did it at Indiana was we kind of studied the sociology alongside sort of the biology and chemistry. And so I got to learn about both things at the same time, which is really valuable. I didn't think about it too much when I was doing it, but really valuable now because we're essentially solving human problems, right? And what we're doing with swimmers is, in any athlete, is not divorced from the social context that it's happening in. And so you have to respect a lot of the social history of the athlete that you're working with in order to kind of get through to them on the sports science side and kind of meet them where they're at. And so that was super valuable being a human biology major.
Right.
And so when I kind of decided that I didn't really want to go to dental school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And so one of my friends had, his name is Eric Ress. He was doing his fifth year and he ended up doing a master's in what became the same master's program that I was in, the exercise physiology program at Indiana. And so at Indiana, me and my graduate school colleague were kind of the last two people to go through this center. It was the only dedicated swimming science center in the country called the Councilman Center for the Science of Swimming, named after Doc Councilman, who is a famous swim coach at Indiana, who's kind of the pioneer of science and swimming and kind of combining the two and using that to guide your curiosity and your coaching. And so that was super valuable working with Joel Steger there and all of the other grad students that were there, just a super rich environment to study swimming in from a very different perspective because you aren't kind of wrapped into the daily grind of trying to get people to go back and forth better. Is you can sort of sit and say, well, do we need to radically rethink about what we're doing here with training swimmers and what is kind of the ground rules that we're operating by and what are the fundamental principles governing this? Yeah. And so that was the master's aspect. And then Dr. Steger retired. And so when I decided to do a PhD, I ended up working with my PhD advisor, Robert Chapman. He's currently the sports medicine and science director for USA Track and Field. And so I kind of did a little foray into running for my dissertation. And so that was kind of fun getting to look at a similar sport, very different, especially social context, but also just a very different physiological context as well.
From that academic background, straight to USA Swimming, or what was the path to get kind of from school to where you are now?
I got super lucky that a job opened up right when I could kind of jump from school. I was actually halfway through a swimming-based dissertation project when I applied for this job. I ended up getting the job, and because that was human subjects research, I really couldn't finish it. So I actually scrapped half a dissertation and started all the way back over with a new project and ended up doing that a data-based running project for my dissertation. So that was in 2022. So I ended up finishing up like the last year and a half of school remotely.
The other, I'll call them Olympic sports and NGBs, as far as kind of data analyst jobs, are they similar spot to USA Swimming? And obviously there's, you know, different budgets and things like that, but you mentioned track and field, others, are they kind of in a similar area from that standpoint?
Not quite. We're really lucky at USA Swimming that we have a lot of resources at our disposal. We have a huge membership base and things like that. And same thing with track and field to an extent. Most NGBs aren't necessarily going to have dedicated positions. But if somebody is looking to get into Olympic sport, Elliot Schwartz at the USOPC. So the USOPC handles a lot of the data science for a lot of other NGBs. And helps them. They do amazing work with like figure skating, medal projections, and they also have awesome programs with data sharing agreements and things like that. So even if you are a student that's interested in sports data and you're having a hard time getting in with the MLB or NFL team and things like that, We are always looking for, if you are interested in like handball or something like that, is like, we are always looking for help on that end, and they are there. So Elliot is an awesome person with connecting people and providing them resources. So that's where a lot of the jobs are. So that USOPC job board is really important.
Yeah, just trying to figure out the math of optimal skating scores, gymnastic scores, like that's almost a thing in and of itself that you don't have to worry about, thank goodness.
It makes me feel really lucky because our sport is really independent, right? It's like there's not anybody that's disrupting you theoretically while you're swimming in your own lane. And it's very objective, right? It's if you hit the wall first, you win the race, and it's that simple. There's no judges. Yep. There's no any of that.
Yeah, clock doesn't lie, as my coach used to yell at me. Just kind of a fun thing to wrap this portion up. Trials and Olympics coming up. What's a favorite storyline or two that you're going to keep an eye on that your, again, average sports fan who's parachuting in for these couple of big meets should keep an eye on?
I think on our women's side is, I would say, expect somewhere between one and, I'll say on the high end, five world records at Olympic trials.
Oh, wow.
I think five are possible for the swimmers. We were talking about Kate Douglas. She's not a household name right now if you're kind of outside of swimming, but I think she's going to be the story of the summer, along with like Reagan Smith and Tori Husk. Is these women are just in probably the most incredible thing that I've seen this year is Kate Douglas took 48 strokes to swim one of the fastest 200 breaststrokes for women that I've seen in prelims ever. So to put into context so she went two minutes and 26 seconds in that race, taking 48 strokes. The only
48 total strokes in the race?
48 total strokes for a long course meters, 200 breaststroke. So first is no man in our database has taken under 50 strokes. So that's number one. Number two, if you index by, and this is just in our database, so it's not all swims, but if you sort by only people that have gone under 227 in the 200 breaststroke for women, nobody has taken less than 61 strokes.
Wow.
And so she's, and we're talking about like efficiency in the sport and how to manipulate water and move through water. She is a magician at that. It's just an incredible thing to watch. She just slips through water, and it is just incredible. So expect big things out of her. Tori Husk has been swimming super well, and so has Reagan Smith. Those on the ladies' side. On the men's side, we've got a few different storylines. Is kind of the Caleb Dressel comeback. He took about a year and a half off, which if you ask like most people adjacent to swimming, is they say like, oh, you take time off, that's a death knell. Nobody comes back, and he is swimming, I would argue, better than ever. So he's really doing a really good job of kind of keeping himself really, really in great shape and in a great spot to do well and have, it might not feel like a comeback for people that watched the last Olympics and saw him do amazing, but it really is a comeback. We joked, it's kind of like Michael Jordan, you know, like the I'm back. Yep. Sort of memo. Yeah. And in the young guys, as well, I don't know how many are going to make the Olympic team. But this is one of our main data challenges is at, on our world championship team is we had a 16-year-old boy. And then, so it's like, I've got to communicate data to a 16-year-old who, he's a really smart kid. So I'm sure he's at a high level of math for high schooler. But then also a 31-year-old who has a full-time job and has been doing this forever. So these young men, Thomas Heilman is the kid that made the world championships team last year. Maximus Williamson is another one from my hometown, that's doing really well. So hopefully some of these young guys make the team, because those, man, they're really, really good at swimming.
Mind-blowing. How open are swimmers to, I'll just say, data in general? Because you hear, I mean, any sport, you hear some are very open, some are not. I'm curious, just in general, how are swimmers responding to the possibility of having all this additional information?
They always want more. They want more, they want faster, because really the game, we call it the game of hundreds, right? Is we're dealing with, if I get 0.5% better, that is a salient improvement for me. And so they're looking for any small edge that they can possibly get. And if they feel like they're slipping in any facet of their race, they are dialed into all of this. So they always want the most. I think in terms of reception, it is always going to be that same challenge that I was just talking about, of making sure that you're establishing the ground rules, communicating what's going on. And that's been the great thing about, we're kind of behind professional sports. And so I have the luxury of kind of sitting and watching like baseball and basketball and football to see, okay, what mistakes are they making along the way? And I think that's the big thing that we saw in baseball is teams' ability to not only collect the data, but also communicate and empower and give insight and correct with the data is almost more important than actually having the data itself.
All right. So a few just quick playing favorites as we wrap things up here, to get to know you a little better. What's your favorite number and why?
29. Mm-hmm. For kind of two reasons, a little bit funny of, this is back when, this is going to age me, is AOL Instant Messenger was a thing. And we were coming up with screen names as my brother had 29 in his. And I was like, oh, why'd you pick 29? He's like, oh, if you add up my birth month and my birthday, it makes 29. I was like, oh, I wonder what that is for me. And it was 29, and he got really upset about that. Right. But then beyond that is favorite baseball player growing up, Adrian Beltre.
Oh, okay.
Also the number 29, yeah.
So I think that answers the next question. I was going to ask, favorite athlete as a kid, Beltre? Anyone
yes,
else?
Yeah. Adrian Beltre absolutely is just kind of the combination of joy and intensity is something that I hope to bring to my work. And I love when I see that out of athletes. In terms of swimming, is Aaron Pearsall growing up. He is a backstroker, is just like the most chill Southern California guy.
Yep.
And just another one that could just slip through the water. It was just amazing to watch him race.
Yeah, he was a California dude for sure. Your favorite event to swim back in the racing days?
Unpopular answer, but 400 individual medleys. Yeah, exactly. That's the reaction out of most people. I think when it goes badly, it's awful. When it goes well. So for those that aren't familiar, individual medley, you swim all four strokes. The 400 is the longest version of this. So it's sort of like the decathlon of swimming, if you will. You have to have pretty much every tool in your toolbox, at least average or even better, to be able to swim this. And so when you put together a good one of those, it's like you feel really good about yourself. But probably, yeah, I had to stay away from that one as I got older. But short course 200 backstroke was my event when I was in college.
Yeah, I swam much lower level than you. Swam the 400 IM once. I was like, no, I'm good. And never doing that again.
And that is most people. Yeah, that is a valid response.
Do you have a favorite race that you have watched in person on TV, just like a favorite swimming race?
I think like the cop-out answer is the 4x100 relay in 2008 is like, and really all of Phelps's races in 2008. In terms of international swimming, I hope that I haven't seen my favorite race yet.
Right.
If I had to pick one that I've seen in person, is it is really not that like internationally or historically relevant to anybody but the people that were there. But my friend in high school, he got his first Olympic trials cut in the mile. So it's a 30 lap race. And with 150 to go, so in the longer races, they have counters at the end of the pool that help the swimmers count their laps. Mm-hmm. And so I was counting for my friend, and with 3 laps to go, the power goes out in the building.
Oh.
And so he kind of like pops his head up and he's looking around, and I'm yelling out like, Ted, go, 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 go. And so he, basically all the coaches that were hand timing their swimmers in the same heat, kind of dropped what they were doing and went behind his lane so they could get, stopwatch times, because presumably the timing system went out as well. And so he ended up being just under his Olympic trials cut. And that's how he got his first Olympic trials cut was, with the power out in the pool.
Good. That's a good
which
one.
It was just an incredible thing to watch and just kind of how he recovered from that and didn't let it affect him. It was very, very elite athlete of him.
Yeah. And finally, do you have a favorite how did I get here moment? One of those moments where my career has gotten me here and this is really cool and you're kind of able to soak it in. I imagine something's coming this summer, but so far, what do you got?
Yeah, definitely going to the Olympics is going to be a huge one. I would say meeting. So on my first introduction to USA Swimming was I drove from Bloomington, Indiana to Colorado Springs. 3 days later, I was on a plane to Sydney, Australia. And that was my first 3 days at USA Swimming. And so at that meet is Aaron Pearsall was actually one of the, celebrity captains that we had for, it was a really cool, duel in the pool meet that we did with Australia. That was a lot of fun. So getting to meet Aaron Pearsall was definitely bucket list item. And then I got to have breakfast with Katie Ledecky, in the fall and just kind of, it's like, I was sitting there and it's like, I'm talking to Katie Ledecky about her race strategy and her stroke technique and talk about life. She is as much as she is an amazing swimmer, she is an even better person. And so just getting to know her and all of the athletes as people has been super special because they're all just elite people and awesome people to get to know. And she's no exception. She got the Presidential Medal of Freedom the other day and was like, oh my gosh, you have enough medals. Right. It's like, that's an incredible one. It's like, oh my goodness, but not a more deserving person. She's awesome. But that was a big one. It's like, man, I get to sit here and talk about her race strategy or stroke technique with her. It's like, this is cool. I have a cool job.
That's great. That is for sure. Great. Good story to wrap things up with. Good luck at trials. Good luck at the Olympics, Curtis. And Curtis Goss, performance support specialist for the U.S. national team. Thanks for joining us here on Expected Value. Back in the True Media Studios, I'm Paul Carr. Thanks again to USA Swimming's Curtis Goss for joining us on the show. You can follow him on Twitter at Curtis Goss, G-O-S-S-13. And USA Swimming's site and Twitter account will help keep you updated on everything going on at trials and Olympics over the next couple months. I'm joined now by our new producer, Brian Duffley. Brian, welcome. Thank you in advance for all your work on the show. Before we talk about what Curtis said, let's give the listeners a quick summary of where you're coming from, what you did before joining True Media this year.
Yeah, so this is my first year at True Media. I previously spent the 2023 season with the Detroit Tigers. I was with their AA affiliate in Erie, Pennsylvania. And in 2022, I was with the Chicago White Sox, similarly doing video, advanced scouting kind of role. And that was with their single A affiliate in Kannapolis, North Carolina. So kind of like the unofficial third year in sports, I would say. I guess if you count Sports Info Solutions before that, fourth. But yeah, recently out of school, worked for the team there at Augustana College, and happy to be part of the True Media team.
Yeah, let's not bury the lead here. This is now an all CCIW pod with you, an Augustana alum, me, a Wheaton College and Illinois alum. So CCIW very slowly taking over the world, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was always great to go to those Wheaton games and sit on top of a hill with no coverage and just have the wind howling for every single D3 baseball game I had to sit through.
That's right. Been there, done that. Calling games on picnic benches and all sorts of things back in the day. All right. So, Brian, you listened in on this interview with Curtis. Tell me, you're not coming from a swimming background, so I know you have a different perspective. What did you take away from the conversation?
Yeah, I definitely lacked a lot of insight as far as some of the things that I guess his role entails, but also just like the swimming world. I, for instance, didn't understand, I guess, the grand scale of the Olympic trials for swimming. Like, I obviously knew that I was competitive amongst the people who were going for the Olympic nod, but at the same time, like, that it could arguably be a bigger deal than the actual Olympics themselves.
Yeah.
And then along with just working within baseball and all the different tech that we've used, it was interesting to hear about kind of the, I guess, ups and downs of the tech advances that they're dealing with in the swimming world and how finding wearable devices that are actually, within the rules of Olympic trials and things like that are tough to find. But at the same time, also just kind of how it's in the infancy of everything as far as what is, I guess, working and what's even worth collecting at this point, yeah. and how so much of it's still manual in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I was struck also by, I'll just call it, the data limitations in general. And this is not an indictment on USA Swimming or the sport. It's just, you know, it's just reality. You know, you and I and a lot of people were used to working in major sports leagues that have tons of tracking data for, you know, from the major league baseball mm-hmm. teams all the way down through the minors, like you used to work with, and you can do so much with all that data. But there are so many limitations here at play. There's money is, you know, kind of number one, because, yeah. you know, there's competition in the sense that USA Swimming is mostly doing its own thing. There's no overarching, you know, World Aquatics as an organization is not pushing these things across all the different national governing bodies in the same way that, you know, MLB or the NFL are doing these things for all these teams. So Team USA and Australia Swimming are kind of operating in parallel universes in that way. And the practical stuff's pretty interesting to me. You know, water makes video tracking difficult. The athletes are wearing minimal clothes, and so there aren't places for tracking devices, especially in races, because every ounce and piece of friction matters. So that's an issue. So it was interesting to see what they've done with the data they have. And yeah. it's an unavoidable challenge at this point, both from a financial and just a practical standpoint.
Yeah, I guess like at the end of the day, when you're doing any sort of analysis of sports, it's always trying to figure out, you know, why an athlete performed the way they did, why they maybe swam faster or swam slower that day. And then a lot of that for his position, he admitted, was still kind of like mood test based almost. Mm-hmm. It's not so much you could wear a heart rate tracker and get an idea of the stress levels during the race and things like that, or their cardio. But then at the same time, if they just admit to having, you know, poor sleep the night before, it's like, yeah, that's very likely the reason that they raced, you know, maybe not up to their full potential that day. And just having those, you know, very subjective mood kind of questionnaires, like if you told that to a baseball analyst, they would, you know, laugh at you and run you off if you're telling them that we're just going to ask the athletes, you know, how yeah. they're feeling as to why they, you know, performed mm-hmm. the way they did, rather than having objective data to look at.
Yep. That was the other thing I jotted down. I was struck by how personal everything is, whether it's data, whether it's strategy, whether it's technique. We talked about, I grew up swimming, and at those lower levels, you're most often just given the general advice, you know, that provides a foundation. You know, this kind of goes for any sport. You know, they teach you how to throw roughly the same way. They teach you how to swing a bat roughly the same way. They teach you roughly how to swim the same way. And so much of that general advice, the higher up you get, is altered or improved to, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of each athlete. He talked about Kate Douglas, who takes so few strokes in her breaststroke mm-hmm. events. So, you know, she's got to be coached differently than someone who has a much quicker stroke and takes a lot more strokes every length of the pool. You know, mm-hmm. I was trained to alternate breathing sides, but I know just watching world-class racing, they're usually not doing that. And Curtis explained some of that data and the reasoning behind it. And I think it all makes sense. It's just a different sort of thing where, because of what data is available, I guess it's maybe, you can almost makes it easier to tailor it to an individual just because there isn't as much. And so you can kind of, you almost have to look at each person individually, each athlete individually, as you're trying to figure out strategy, technique, data, whatever it might be. So just a different thing that way too.
Yeah. He had alluded to the fact that if certain swimmers have individual six styles, it's not so much trying to alter them into Michael Phelps because, you right. know, it's, you simply can't do that, and more so working with what you have. And I think that any sort of sports fan can kind of see that from some sort of perspective where, you know, you watch football and they try to change their quarterback style. You watch baseball and try to change a pitcher's style, or basketball, they're trying to change their jump shot. Just various sports where it's, they got there for the, you know, talent that yeah. they had for a certain reason. You know, they dominated the levels up to that point. Like, it's extremely difficult to get to the pro level in any sport. So then yep. trying to then alter that and have them constantly be changing what they're doing while also trying to be at this level of competition they've never been at before, it's like, it's too much for yep. just about anybody to handle.
Yeah, at some point you just gotta let them go, you know. Mm-hmm. I think of Reggie Miller, I think, just because the Pacers are playing the Knicks in the playoffs and he's on some TNT games.
Yeah,
you know, the way he shoots and his hands cross is just like, you would never ever coach anyone to do that, but it obviously worked for him very well. And at some point mm-hmm. you just kind of, all right, this is just what we're gonna go with. So, and swimming's kind of the same way in that regard, you know.
So, yeah.
All right. Thanks, Brian. Thank you one more time to USA Swimming's Dr. Curtis Goss for joining us on the show. We don't have any other swimming guests in our archives, at least not yet, but we do have 72 other shows with people from across the sports analytics world, including our most recent episodes with Tim Gibbons, former Orioles AAA hitting coach, Allison Laux oversees the analytics team at ESPN, and Matt Chang, whose team won the NFL's Big Data Bowl this year. While you're in the archives, please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts, and we appreciate any sharing across social media as well. We'll be back in a couple weeks looking to talk with an NFL guest about the schedule and other football-related things. Until then, on behalf of producer Brian Duffley and all of us here at True Media, I'm Paul Carr. Thank you for listening to Expected Value, the podcast that goes inside the sports analytics world.